it's open for anybody to ask a question or make a point to either the speakers. But we all know what the procedure. You put a queue in the speaking queue, and then I'll ask you to speak. Does anybody want to kick off with a point or a question to one or other of the speakers? Can I ask Bill to explain something? What is a Henry VIII clause?
Henry VIII clause is a clause written to a national parliament, basically says that the government can change the law without having another act of parliament. So it gives power to the executive. Of course, a lot of times they're fairly sensible things, which, you know, you wouldn't, if you want to make small technical changes, or you just have some technical regulations and you don't have to bother Parliament with changing, you know, the exact diameter of widgets if they're laid down in law. But in this case, it's sweeping. So pretty much any law in the country can now be amended by a government minister as long as they're implementing the trade agreement.
Okay, thanks. So that's what Henry VIII did. Right. Anybody got a first question? Yeah, Mike.
It was just to add to something that Bill said. He mentioned that he hadn't been able to look into the implications for benefit claimants from Europe, and that's something that's taken up quite a bit of my time at the moment. The way that works is people from Europe already in the country have had to make an application for a status in the UK. That's quite a sort of telling word, really. And there are sort of two types of statuses. One is a settled status, which is granted to those who've been in Britain for 5 years. And the other one is pre-settled status, which is very fuzzy. I don't really understand it myself. It doesn't automatically mean you can claim benefits, whereas, as I say, you can claim benefits if you've got settled status. Pre-settled status for a lot of people would allow them to claim benefits at some point in the future, partly based on working history. So people with settled status, they're sort of okay. As I say, people without settled status, some of them might be up a gum tree and would have to find employment. And we've had a right headache trying to gain the right ID and the right proof of people's history in the UK, because you need to submit evidence to be granted either settled or pre-settled status. And for, you know, in my line of work, getting the ID and and enough information is the main problem. I'm not sure what's going to happen to new people coming in. As Bill mentioned, they won't be able to claim benefits, and they'll have to find employment in order to get money. So it's been a bit of a mess overall, and the deadline's tomorrow. So people in the UK after tomorrow who haven't made one of these applications, and these applications can take months and months and months to be processed, they'll be up a gum tree unless they can find work. Yeah, so just thought I'd mention that. Cheers.
Okay, thanks, Howard.
Right, I'm unmuted. Thanks very much. Just wondering whether Mike and Bill think that Brexit, you know, the formal sort of acceptance of it, and will give even greater permission than it's given so far for the spread of this sort of horrible ethno-nationalism, which we have to a greater extent than for a long time. Any ideas on that? Or will it do the opposite? Will it actually, as a result of the thing being made official, will it die down?
Okay, Bill or Mike, do you want to say anything?
Or anyone else?
Yeah, I can come in on this. I think that one of the things I probably should have said, which is that the EU also achieved its aim very much in showing that the benefits of being out of the EU are not as good as being in. So they defended the idea that there's a benefit to being a member of the club. So in terms of our ethno-nationalists have said there's a price that they're willing to pay so far for being outside the EU. But then we're waiting for, I've got a friend who works in passport control in, up in the northeast, and he's just waiting to catch all the Brexiteers with who are going to try and cross the border with too much in their pockets. You can only bring £10,000 over now, and you know you've got limited amounts of values of goods that you can carry through with the nothing to declare channel. And they're going to ping them all, and they're all going to be in for a bit of a shock when they discover, you know, that they can only go to Europe now for 90 days out of any 180. So all those people who've got a retirement home in the sun, if they haven't managed to get settled status with their local country, are going to find that they can't stay there for more than a quarter of the year now, and that sort of thing. So possibly it should put things to bed in that there's no law, you know, that they have managed to close down the open borders, and they'll turn around and say any immigration now will be controlled. But I think that the possibility is that the EU is going to be a bugbear for years to come, because it's going to be every time there's going to be any dispute, it's going to be how unfair the EU is. And the toddler will throw another tantrum and then go to bed at the time its parents told it to.
Okay, thanks. Did you want to add anything, Mike?
Just briefly. I think a big part of the motivation for many people who voted Leave was on the issue of immigration. I suppose I'm generalising, but I'm sure a lot of Leave voters didn't, analyse the economic implications either way, and voted based on assuming that leaving the EU would reduce immigration. But as far as I know, leaving the EU won't affect the way that the asylum seekers are processed and come into the country, and then often gain refugee status. So that won't be impacted on at all by Brexit, at least not directly. I think a lot of the assumptions that some of the immigration minded Leave voters made won't be impacted by Brexit. Yeah, cheers, thanks.
Okay, Paddy.
When I've talked to some Brexit voters, one of the other issues that came up was this idea of sovereignty, you know, British sovereignty. I don't quite understand it really, but I really like Bill's analogy of the baby going to bed when the parents say. I think that's really good. I shall use that. But another issue was just general poverty, levels of poverty, and the kind of protest vote around the Red Wall and that sort of thing. I just want to ask Bill. You mentioned, yeah, the deal is tariff and quota free trade. But I read somewhere that this is going to be the biggest avalanche of red tape in 50 years, because, of course, there's all the regulations have got to be changed for all imports and exports between the mainland and Northern Ireland as well. And I'm just wondering, I suppose the real question that I'm interested in, sort of long term, is this sort of, you know, this amount of red tape, is this likely to drive up costs for consumers, you know, generally? I know we don't like that word, consumers, but, costs in the shops. Are people going to... What I'm really interested in is are the Red Wall voters going to end up being punished in the pocket? And are they going to end up regretting how they voted when... or do you think that it's going to be six of one, half dozen of the other, that people aren't going to really notice that the cost of living is not going to be really an issue? So I'd be interested to just know what Bill thinks about that.
So I've read somewhere that there's an estimate from the HMRC that it's going to cost £7 billion across the whole economy. And whilst a lot of it, so the idea is it's going to be regulation light, like you say, but in terms of just being a pain in the bum that you've got to fill a form in every time you want to do something. So I suppose the analogy is if you had to fill in a form every time you wanted to go to Birmingham, which would be a right old chew for the comrades in the West Midlands branch, even if no one was really checking it, but there was a chance that they might check it. So you've got to fill the form in every time. And yes, so each trip will only take you a few minutes per form. It's going to add across the whole economy. That adds up to a lot of people. But I think they're talking about there's been some sort of talk about 5% on prices, which within the range of considering that there's 2% on inflation anyway, generally, people might notice some things, but not so bad that people will suddenly find, you know, it's not going to be Weimar Republic style increase in costs. It'll just be a gradual creep up here and there. There's a video doing the rounds of an eel farmer who's having some sort of problems sending to Europe now, because although he can fill in the forms, his customers have to fill in the forms as well. And of course, everyone will get used to it in the end, possibly, or they'll just go to the shop that doesn't make them fill in forms. But there are some real costs, and Michael Gove's defending on it, trying to say that it's going to make businesses better at being able to deal with the rest of the world, and that, you know, these costs apply everywhere. So, you know, everyone's going to get used to filling in these forms, and it'll make us more competitive worldwide, or some such nonsense. But the fact is that they have paid a price for sovereignty. Essentially, they've said that we want to be sovereign, and therefore these costs, we can't stay in the customs union or the single market. There's got to be customs clearances. Customs clearances cost money. And I've been in the dark until this week for my job. I still don't know, because I'm reading somewhere that, you know, customs will hold back books and things like that. And, like, you know, because there's if they charge postage, there's VAT on the postage. So is everything going to get held back because it's not been VAT declared? I imagine customs and excise are going to have an absolute meltdown trying to implement whatever rules. And I trying to read the government website is just impossible. I have no idea what's going to happen when I get back to work next week.
Okay, thanks. Anybody else? Don't have to discuss Brexit, discuss the pandemic or anything that happened. Looks like Paddy again.
Yeah, well, seeing as nobody else is asking anything, I've got one other question to ask about Brexit. Bill, you mentioned energy and that how that's going to be changed. And well, it occurred to me that one way that the UK manages to even out its intermittent energy supply from renewables, like, you know, wind and tide and solar and so forth, is to swap energy with France on the grounds that you don't tend to get the same weather affecting both simultaneously. So, you know, when it's sunny in France and it's not in Britain, the energy comes this way. And then when it's windy in Britain, anyway, you get the idea. Well, you know, does this Brexit deal mean the end of this exchange? And if that's the case, is that going to set back the UK's pretty demanding renewable energy targets? What have you gleaned on that subject?
Well, that's a good question. There is actually a chapter on energy. So the UK maintained access to the European energy market. So that was what was hammered out. But it was not so subtly mentioned during the talks that if you take away our fish, we can take away your energy, with exactly the same arguments. And what people are saying now is that this energy deal will come up at the same time as the fish deal in future. So unless and until the UK can find some sort, you know, build another nuclear power plant or whatever you, to replace the demand it draws on from the rest of Europe, then this is going to keep coming up and coming up. And of course, as you rightly say, I mean, the point is, this is a good argument against sovereignty. The wind is always blowing somewhere in Northern Europe, but it's not always blowing over the British Isles. So being able to draw down that energy and get it is kind of a key ask, and one that I think they're not going to get rid of anytime soon, and particularly as the value of that energy market is absolutely huge compared to the value of fish. So we're still in the energy market. There's an entire section, reservation number 8. I've got the document in front of me. energy-related activities, and the UK will still be able to get involved.
Okay, Howard.
Can I just say that I've just put something on the not events calendar.
Useful links.
Just put something on the useful links to click on. If you click on it, ignore the fact that the first thing you see is a picture of Bob Geldof and somebody called A.A. Gill. Some of you may know him, a journalist who actually died a couple of years ago, but who in 2016 wrote a piece about Brexit, about leaving the European Union, which is absolutely brilliant, believe it or not. You wouldn't have expected of him. It's relatively long, but Joy sort of drew my attention to it. I thought, I'm not going to read that, but I started reading it and I couldn't stop. It's not that long, but it's a really interesting and undeniably good take on why people voted for Brexit and the kind of people who voted for it and the likely impact. So, if you've got, 5 minutes or so, have a look, click on the link and, read what's there.
Well, since we haven't got any more questions, perhaps you can summarise.
Thanks very much. I'm only just ready. Oh, dear. No, I can't, honestly. It's far too subtle for me to summarise. You'll have to read it.
Fair enough.
I've just not quite sort of taken up. I've only read it myself in the last half hour or so.
Mike, could you just Howard, could you just post the actual link? Because what you've done is you've posted a plain text message rather than a link. So could you just post the link?
Sorry, but if I click on it, it does work. Hang on, what are we looking at now? Useful links. It wouldn't let me do that because it said it was too long. But it said you can.
If you just post the URL by itself rather than the whole text, yeah, because there's a text character limit on messages in Discord.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Okay, hang on a sec. Yeah, it is there now. Yeah. Does that work now, Paddy?
Yeah, I think that's better. Yeah.
Does that work?
Sorry. Yeah, that's okay.
You must be reading it.
Okay.
Anyways, anybody else got it?
Sorry, I was going to say that link works okay. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
We can ask questions and discuss other things but Brexit, if you want, like the pandemic.
Adam, I've got something else to say.
Okay, yeah.
Sorry, nobody else is...
I don't know why, but carry on.
Yeah, well, nobody else is saying very much. I just wanted to go back to something that Mike said, actually. what Mike started out saying was that the virus started in a seafood market, but I'm sure that it started in a wet market. A wet market's not the same thing as a seafood market, and bats aren't normally considered seafood anyway. But what I was actually going to say was that Mike said, how does 2020 affect the class struggle? I mean, it's a really important question. And, if you only have to think how it's affected us, over 2020, how we've had to just adapt to it. I mean, how does it affect the class struggle? I think it's a question that's worth, sort of exploring here. And it's been a massive change for us. I don't know if we're going to, if it's ever going to be quite the same after this. What does anybody else think?
You mean it's not going to be the same for us or for everybody?
Adam, Richard Botterill's in the speaking queue.
Okay, Richard.
Yeah, I just wanted to give a very quick answer to my first thoughts on what Paddy said. What's 2020 going to do for class struggle? Well, what we see is how adaptable human beings are, in a very general sense, how so many people got used to working from home. They, let's say, get used to it. They could do it. They could do things that they hadn't done before. They stopped doing things that they regularly used to do. And I think there's some hope in there somewhere that, you know, this is what happens throughout history. The human race carry on living a certain way, working the same old, until something, some unexpected event occurs, and then there's quite a shift. Doesn't always mean it's things don't sometimes go back to how they were before, but you see that there is a possibility there. You know, people can start doing something new, like changing jobs, and they change their way of life. They have to think out of the box and start doing something that they'd not done before. They were afraid to try it. So, you know, I think there's hope there. That's all.
Do you want to say anything on that, Mike? It's your fire. Okay, Mike.
Yeah, first on the whole bats in a seafood wet market thing. Yeah, I was trusting Wikipedia there. I don't know if bats used in traditional medicine are a staple of wet seafood markets, but yeah, I'm guessing all sorts of animals were sold there, because there was talk of pangolins as well, wasn't there, having a link, and yeah, pangolins aren't seafood, but yeah, anyway, that's by the by. On the whole class struggle question, which yeah, I think it's certainly something that we should pay attention to. As I mentioned, you know, a few of the capitalist class have profited a lot out of the pandemic, but presumably also that there's been a drop in profits for other aspects or other areas in the economy, and you know, the stock market crashed when the pandemic hit. I think it's widened the gulf between the capitalist class and the working class. And of course, you know, the working class is suffering most out of it. And with any sort of crisis, there's the danger that people are understandably preoccupied with their own survival rather than thinking of wider issues such as the nature of society and what might replace capitalism. So. And yeah, you know, we can't criticize people for that, you know, sort of function, you know, focusing on, you know, getting enough income to survive. But on the other hand, after a crisis, I think it was one of Paul Bennett's questions in the quiz the other week that the record attendance for a party meeting was in 1947, I think it was it over 1,000? And of course, that was a couple of years after the last major crisis, the Second World War. So maybe just after a crisis, when people's lives settle down into a new normal, and they've got the ability to reflect a bit more, maybe that's when people will start questioning, you know, how they got to their current situation. So yeah, maybe it'll be a couple of years down the line before there's a more noticeable change in the class struggle. Cheers, Tom.
Okay, Bill.
Yeah, so just to say on the Rona, the virus, one thing that I think that it needs hyping up quite a lot is just what, and I think when we look back on it, we'll say this, what a marvel of modern technology is the fact that we've now got vaccines within a year of a disease coming into being. So not only had they mapped the genome of the damn thing within a month or two of it coming notice, but the vaccine now exists. And my brother got an ITU nurse, got his jab this week. So, you know, it's here, and, you know, 500,000 people have been jabbed. That's half a million out of 64 million. not bad to get going. And I think it's an incredible thing that might be the thing that beats it. But also I saw a very interesting map, which is because, again, international agreements, the companies are refusing to allow generic versions in the global south, in developing countries. There's some countries in Africa that probably just won't be able to see the vaccine for another 2 or 3 years. And so the inequalities of capitalism have reared their head. And instead of a collective worldwide cooperative attempt to wipe the disease out through vaccination, we have the various nation states of the world fighting each other to see who can get access to the most of the jabs that they can get their hands on now. When the capacity is there, clearly, to produce enough to vaccinate the whole world. I mean, the only thing now, really, is literally the logistics of how we build enough factories and enough cold storage to get the vaccine out to absolutely everyone.
Okay, anybody else? Howard.
Just to sort of mention the pandemic and the virus again, I think Mike was absolutely right to say the days when people were clapping the NHS 8 o'clock every evening seem a long time ago. And I think, you know, attitudes have changed quite. I mean, it's a good job this, I think, that this vaccine is being rolled out, you know, if it is effective, because otherwise, I think we'd be in for sort of, you know, significantly disastrous consequences. Just to give an example, just a small personal anecdote. I mean, I went for a walk in a local park today in Swansea, and I put a message on the local community Facebook page, which I'm a member of, together with several hundred other people in the area, when I got back. And I'll just read you what message I put on. It was deliberately provocative in a way, but it said, "In Brimmel Park today, by the playgrounds, there are groups of women chatting at the closest possible quarters and even hugging one another, unmasked, obviously. What do we expect to happen except for this kind of thing to trigger even more drastic measures?" I put that on about 4:30 this afternoon. As a result, there have been 139 comments since. A lot of them sort of pretty hostile. One of them, for example, says, "With respect." As soon as somebody starts a sentence with respect, you know what they're going to say. "With respect, this is ridiculous. You're posting about other people's comings and goings like the bloody Gestapo. Suicide rates and mental health issues are through the roof right now. The hug could be exactly what that person needed right now. And either way, some of us don't want to live in a world where hugging someone is a bad thing." Somebody else wrote, "Why don't you mind your own business and concentrate on yourself instead of others and what they are up to? Sick and tired of seeing posts like this. If you've kept yourself to yourself, you've nothing to worry about, have you?" A somewhat more sensible person wrote, "The idea that there is a pandemic caused by a virus that people cannot see with their own eyes is too abstract for certain people. Add to those the anti-vaxxers and the supporters of conspiracy theories, and there we go." Reasonable comment, I must say, but a lot of them weren't. A lot of them were pretty hostile, and you know, doesn't bode well, and certainly would bode a lot more badly if this vaccine sort of weren't in the offing.
Okay, Steve.
I agree, comrades. Right, I'm sorry to abuse something called. Just put something up that I've just come across as I was hunting down that A.A. Gill article, which, having briefly fleshed through it, it's quite interesting, as Howard said. And I'm sorry, I can't summarise it. I get lost. But the link is, we're going to get something absolutely wonderful in January. Because Jeremy Corbyn is launching a thing called the Foundation for Peace and Justice, or something like that. Sorry, I forgot me, I've changed my screen. Yeah, roll up for the Peace and Justice Project with good old Jezza. So we can expect even more bullshit from the in the coming months. I don't know. Maybe we could get something out in time on the, because I think it's the 17th of January that thing's been announced. Yabba dabba doo.
Anybody else? But can I say something about this? Working from home, won't that make trade union organisation more difficult? Anyways, in the meantime, somebody's come up. Mike.
Yes, thanks, Adam. A few quick comments. Globally, it's going to mean the virus is going to mean a lot of jobs being lost globally. So the working class of the world are going to be worse off in a year's time, in 2 years' time, in 3 years' time. That's not going to be nice. The virus has already mutated twice with spectacular effects. When it becomes, and it's likely to become, more brilliant, then we are in total disarray. Society basically will be ruled by governments, and they'll decide what you want, what you're able to do. To go back on to Howard's last thing, I suppose, well, those people want to hug each other. That's up to them. They know the dangers. They've been told the dangers. You mustn't try and please them. They're old enough to know what they're doing. People who have children they are somewhat different from the rest of us. They are taking risks every day when they're meeting at the nurseries. And I just keep away from them because they know what they're doing. Good luck to them. I wouldn't tell them off. I'll tell them off to come near me, but I wouldn't tell them off if that have their own little bubbles trying to protect each other. They are trying to raise children very young in a new environment. One thing that missed out, I don't want to mention anything in England and Brexit and all that sort of stuff and the virus is done in England. Worldwide, it's really nasty and it's really going to be hard on it. One thing that was good last year, well, this year, we're not finished yet, still the calendar year, was massive amount of voting that took place in 50 states where people, mostly poor voters, got a vote for a change. With the pandemic, they were allowed to put their vote in. Normally, their voting is suppressed, discouraged, with loads of extra hassles, and to get the vote, you sometimes have to do poor, poor people in the 50s. Some of them are very fucking racist, keeping people down for a long time. So it's nice to see a little bit more democratic voting in the prototype democratic place in the 50 states. What will come back out of it, we don't know. The thing is, the Black Lives Matters thing will continue because there's so many phones around with cameras. If you hadn't seen the video of that person being killed over 10 minutes, nobody would have paid any attention to another Black person killed by a police in America. The fact that people could see that, really relate to it, they know that will have an important effect. But negatively, we're going to have them isolated in our homes, and that's going to also have a disastrous effect on organizations like trade unions. I've covered about five things there, but I'll just stop.
Hey, thanks. The other Mike Foster.
Thanks, Steve, for posting the link to Jeremy Corbyn's new project. I remember reading a little bit about that at the time, and I couldn't really work out what it was aiming to do. I'll have to read it again. It mentions in the link that you posted that it's pitched as an apolitical organisation. And I'm guessing that's to try and attract support of people who may be disillusioned of with you know the parliamentary system, in particular Corbynites who otherwise might be at risk of drifting back to left unity. All of those you know sort of latent Corbyn supporters who have been left adrift now that Starmer is in charge of Labour, you know, where are they going to go? So I'm guessing he's trying to attract them rather than them perhaps drifting to something like left unity. So yeah, that might be where that particular section of the left is channeled into. But as I say, I wasn't quite sure what this organization of Corbyn's is set up to do. Is it supposed to be some sort of left-wing think tank? That's sort of what I imagine it to be. Also, as a bit of an aside, about a year ago, George Galloway launched the Workers' Party of Britain, which seems to have done nothing. He described it as economically radical with an independent foreign policy and unequivocally committed to class politics. But, you know, what have they done since? Instantly, the logo for this Workers' Party of Britain looks more or less identical to the graphic I put together for the summer school just gone, the technology one, a sort of a cog shape, which I certainly didn't copy from the Workers' Party of Britain. Maybe they copied it from me, who knows? Yeah, but I'm not suggesting we check them out, but yeah, they've sort of disappeared into nothing and obviously didn't channel that sort of Corbynite momentum support, which at the moment is drifting around, much like you know, the support for Me Too or Black Lives Matter, or even going a bit further back, the Occupy movement. All of that sort of left-wing energy is out there somewhere waiting to be channeled, and I'm guessing Corbyn will hope it will be channeled into his new venture.
Okay, Howard.
I think what's been said about trade union organisation isn't quite right. I'm still active in my trade union, although I'm retired. I'm still active in the branch, and trade union activity since the lockdown has been actually much more active than before. I mean, what's happening now is that whereas, for example, our regular committee meetings would attract maybe 50% of the committee, now we get more or less 100% of people attending because it's easier for them to do so. We've had a couple of general meetings of all the members. The branch has got about 800 members. Normally, we're lucky if we get an attendance in a normal physical meeting of 20 or 30. In the Zoom meetings we've had now, we're getting well over 100. People are taking much greater interest. It's easier for them to attend, to be active, to have their say. So I don't think it's absolutely accurate to say this sort of somehow will mark a sort of downturn in trade union activity. These things are sort of unpredictable. It might well be just the opposite.
That's good to hear. Anyway, Bill.
So it's just a thought that came across my mind. People talking, I think during Howard's previous discussion about how people have reacted to the virus. And I was writing a review of a different book for The Standard, and I was reminded of Peter Lawrence's book, The Last Conflict, which is still available online as a free text, in which the story of his book is that, you know, socialism comes about through a meteorite heading towards the Earth. And everyone comes together to stop the threat of the meteorite, and socialism results. And if there's any one unfortunate part of the coronavirus, it's proven that just doesn't work, because there'd be a president in America going, well, I'll survive the meteor strike. The other people going around going, there is no meteor. And the necessary levels of cooperation just wouldn't come through that sort of threat. So it just seems to be that there's a proof that people really weren't always actually acting their own rational self-interest. Partly because, I think, as some people have pointed out, a lot of the communication early on in the pandemic was quite deceitful. So that the people who were trying to manage public expectation weren't quite as forthcoming as it. So the issue of, like, masks. They said at first, don't bother wearing masks. And the reason they were saying that is because they didn't want people to go out and buy all the masks to stop them being available for the medical people. Now, if they just said, don't buy masks, they do work, but we need them for the medical staff, trusted people, then more people will be more accommodating to the message. But I think as time has gone on and they've shifted around their message, so, you know, they cancelled Diwali, they cancelled Eid, but then decided that the coronavirus would take Christmas off. It's completely ruined any credibility of all the public officials and any of the official messaging that we've got. And of course, no wonder people are starting to get very tetchy about the whole thing, particularly as I think someone said earlier, Tier 4 is basically lockdown in disguise.
Okay, thanks. Paddy?
I just want to go back to something that Mike Brown said. He said something about, you know, people know what they're doing, leave them alone, let them get on with it. I don't know. I'm not sure people do really know what they're doing. I get a sense of, you know, with all the anti-lockdown protests and people just, and young people partying and stuff like that, what you don't get is a sense of, you know, society and social responsibility. I mean, you know, even in, you know, arguments I've had with party members, in fact, you know, there is this sort of lack of a sense of social responsibility, each to his own, each to her own sort of thing. And I find that a bit troubling. But on the other hand, there is an upside to this, just to put a positive spin on it. It is possible to look at this in a positive way. Just when you consider the huge amount of resentment that there is against authorities telling us what to do. When you think how we normally assume that the working class as a whole is in love with this idea of leadership and completely mesmerised and, you know, hypnotised by the concept of leadership and leaders and all this sort of thing. And what you find is that in the last year, people really bitterly resent being told what to do. They resent these restrictions that have been, not necessarily because these restrictions are necessary, but because they're being imposed on them by authorities. And I think that there's, in a way, the two things are linked, you know, the sort of the kind of decay in the sense of general social identity, and also this resentment against authority. The two seem to go together. It seems to me that this is quite possibly a rich seam we should be mining. You know, the one bad thing going with the one good thing. It's almost like people's kind of, there's a kind of natural individualist anarchism that's coming out of people at the moment. You know, and that's maybe something that we should be sort of pushing in what we put out in the future. That, yeah, you're damn right, you should be hating what authorities tell you to do. You should be resenting that, quite right. But at the same time, it's that has to go along with social responsibility, because we're never going to get rid of these bosses and these leaders unless we hang together as a social, entity. So I don't know. Maybe that's how we should we want to think about putting our case in the future. Just a thought.
Okay. Thanks. Anybody else? Okay, John.
Yes, just on the question of trade unions, I was pleasantly surprised to find that our union seemed, the wider organisation, that is, not all of the members, but the wider organisation, seemed to be ready for this pandemic and sprung into action and has been very proactive. And most of the stuff we have via the structures of the union have been very useful, whereas what we have had from the employer has tended to be full of the usual platitudinous nonsense. And there is an idea emanating from the unions that we're not going to go back to the way things were before. Now, the extent to which that'll turn out to be true is yet to be seen, and I think they're perhaps being wildly optimistic, because previous big crises haven't necessarily in the aftermath led to something better immediately or building something better immediately. But everything that happens to the workers within capitalism must have a cumulative effect upon them, and we would certainly hope that there are things to be learned from this, and people will learn those lessons, albeit in a very slow and cumulative process. So I've been very pleased with pleasantly surprised with how responsive the unions have been to this. And I've noted that I don't know how many other people in my workplace have noticed that, because I haven't seen them for a long time. But that's the unfortunate thing. The wider workforce tends not to pay that much attention to anything that comes from the union.
Okay, thanks. Mike, it's okay.
With what Paddy said about the pandemic affecting people's trust in authority, of course we have to, you know, ask about what kind of authority, because there's sort of scientific authority. The government, although it hasn't fooled many people, has said it wants to, you know, follow the science, and of course the work of scientists is absolutely vital in sort of understanding how the virus spreads and how to treat it. But of course there's a danger if people reject that kind of authority, you know, based on as long as it's based on evidence and research. And I know that's sort of slightly stretching the definition of authority, and it wasn't really Paddy's point, but of course we've already seen that a lot of people mistrust the science through conspiracy theories and beliefs that it was the 5G mobile signal that was causing the virus rather than the virus causing the virus. And social media is a breeding ground for those kind of off-the-cuff conspiracy theories which aren't based on anything rational. And I think some of the tech giants are trying to suppress fake news in that way. But yeah, I suppose my point was it's great to mistrust leaders and the structure which allows leaders, but that should be differentiated from relying on the kind of authority that comes from proper science. Cheers.
Talking of leaders, I noticed on a platform says something like under new leadership, all the still think people want to follow leaders. Anyway, anybody else got any questions? Points for discussion? John again, I think.
Right, just briefly on the question of leadership. Although more and more people are becoming distrustful of actual leaders, the concept of leadership still seems to have some appeal for them, because I often hear people saying things that they've heard from politicians who criticise one another and who say, well, it's called leadership and all of this sort of thing. And I hear other workers saying things that echo that and say, where's the leadership there, or where's the direction there? And I'm constantly having to point out that most of what we do, we know what to do and we can do it ourselves, and we don't need this leadership from these in the workplace. Certainly it's people who consider themselves clever people on the bloated salaries, but contribute almost nothing to the work process. So it's a difficult one, the concept of leadership, because we're not really sure whether people have the same idea of it as we do.
Okay, thanks. Paula, I don't know what DQ... Anyway, Paula...
Well, thanks, Adam. I can see you're very strict about it being a Q and not a D. It was just to go back to Howard's point, actually, about, you know, his local Facebook post. When I go around my local park, and it's a very small inner city park in Manchester, and it's very small, but it's the only outside kind of space that we have, really. And there's just, every time I go in there, there's just, and it's mostly Asian people as well, and we're just mainly individuals all walking around in a circuit, like, I don't know, like hamsters on a treadmill, just walking round and round. And it's just so boring. But those people that do this, they're always wearing masks, even though they're outdoors, even though they're not with other people. So they're very much obeying the rules. And then I go on the tram and I go into town and people are wearing the mask, but there's always some men, young men, who don't wear the masks, and it's so they can talk to each other, so they can talk on the phone. I go to my local Tesco and it's always young men again who just stand there in the queue, don't socially distance, and they're yakking to each other. And I think with these young men, it's a sense of, it's not, I don't think there's anything admirable about this in the way that Paddy was suggesting that somehow, you know, they were being anti-authoritarian. I think it's because they're not fearful, whereas ethnic minority people or older people or women even, because they've got caring responsibilities, are fearful, and it's the fearful people that wear the masks, and it's the young people who don't, because they've got no fear. They don't think it's going to affect them. And I think that's a big thing about this pandemic, and I think it's partly why there's a lot of disobedience, is because we keep getting the message that it's the old people that are most at risk. And because we live in a society that's actually very ageist, people think, oh, well, it's just old people. They're going to die anyway. What do we care? So I think there's an element of that going on as well. I think that's all I had to say. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. I never wear a mask except when I have to. Anyway, Bill.
Well, just on that last point quickly, there's been this stat doing the rounds among some of the kind of like libertarian commentators saying that only 677 people under 60 with no pre-existing conditions have died in the UK. And someone's put up the rebuttal that if you don't include people with pre-existing conditions, then technically Harold Shipman didn't kill anyone. Pauses for the laughter he can't hear. But just on this question of authority, I mean, I think I've had a surprising amount of reception to when I said to people, look, you know, the principle is when you're on a ship in a storm, you obey the captain. And then, unfortunately, we're stuck with a bit of a donkey of a captain at this time, and we have to follow the rules as they're laid out now because that's the situation we're in, and we reserve the right to lynch him later. And a lot of people who wouldn't normally respond to that sort of comment have been saying, well, yes, that's exactly right. That's where we're at now, is that, you know, for now we have to obey the government we've got because it's the only one that's out there and anything that could coordinate in a crisis. And the time for vengeance comes later because they've managed to contrive in killing somewhere over, you know, 20,000 more people die than needed to have if they'd have acted a bit sooner.
Anybody else?
Adam, two people in the speaking queue. We're one there.
Why does the speaking queue not keep moving? Right, Richard.
Yeah, just a quick point. Going back to, I think what Mike was saying, was it Michael, it was Bill? Can't remember now, about, and related to what Bill was saying, that when the crisis is actually happening, yes, people will obey the rules and they're sort of quiet for a while. There is some time, maybe a year or two of reflection. And when you sort of come out of it, then you start to get some sort of movement building. I was thinking like the Occupy movement grows out of the financial crisis. It takes like 2 or 3 years before Occupy was suddenly going. And I think the Zeitgeist movement as well. Of course, these things tend to fizzle out. But it's true. People criticise at the time, but they wait till the opportunity comes to get to attack a later stage. Then was thinking about what's happening with the environment, you know, climate change. I just wondered what comrades think about Extinction Rebellion and all that sort of activity. Is that going to carry on, and what form it might take next year and the year after? Thanks.
Janet, did you want to speak?
Yeah, I would like to. I've been listening to some of the medics on these media report programs, and they're always saying, no one's safe until we're all safe. And I'm thinking, do they mean the whole world? They must mean the whole world, because it can't be confined to little old Great Britain. So I'm thinking that people will not be able to tolerate the feeling that they are being protected in this small part of the world. And in other parts of the world, people are still dying in their thousands because they don't have access to the vaccine. So, and also, many people now have relatives spread throughout the world. So I wonder and hope that there will be a concern for other parts of the world, and that will create a feeling of some sort of comradeship between people throughout the world who aren't able to buy the vaccine privately. And maybe that would be a spread of our ideas. At least I hope so.
Hey, thanks. Nobody else? Okay, Mike Brown.
Thanks. Janet, if you're trying to get on the speaking queue, you have to press return. I saw you trying twice. You have to press return to get on it. Just to sum up...
Thanks for reminding me about that. I didn't remember.
Okay. If you can do it now, I'll just finish what I was going to say, and then you can come after me if you like. Sorry, somebody else there. Just to like to say, I'm glad there's one or two people who mentioned people outside Europe and Britain on this discussion. It's nice to have some international feelings for the world. On the climate change that Richard was wondering about, what's going to happen, what's going to get submerged into the usual business as usual?
Okay, Janet, did you want to say something again?
Do I press return now? Sorry, return?
Yeah. Are you in the speaking queue?
She's typing.
I did try to get in.
Yes, you're typing, then press return.
You don't need to. I can see that you want to speak by your being unmuted. Anyway.
But can I be heard now?
Yes, you can be heard, yeah. There's nothing to do with the speaking queue.
But I don't have to repeat what I just said, do I?
No.
Oh, good. All right, then. No.
You can mute yourself if you want.
That's my go for the evening. I'll try again next time. Thank you.
Nobody else want to say anything? Have we been talking long enough? We've been going for an hour and a half of the normal time. Does that either Bill or Mike want to say anything? Ah, Paula. Okay.
Yeah, it's just, does anyone have any predictions for next year about when we'll ever have an actual physical meeting? Or is that too much like science fiction, do you think?
Right, John.
On the question of predictions, they say it's very dangerous to try and make predictions, particularly about the future. So I'll just leave it at that.
But anyway, even if there are physical meetings, these meetings... Okay, Mike.
It's just on the physical meetings. I'm hoping that summer school can be one. Can't remember the date now, early in August, I think. Hopefully that'll be a physical meeting back at Firkcroft. But of course, at the moment, depending on how long it takes to for that, you know, for things to settle down, it might have to be on Discord, depending if Firkcroft can confirm the booking. But yeah, hopefully that'll be one. Yeah, cheers.
Okay, the other Mike.
On that Mike, sorry, Mike was there. Well, I think the probability is about 0.1, i.e. 10% of having a meeting one in this thing. Are you going to do any of the quarterly ones that were proposed about having just a day meetings? Rather than the summer school, you know, sort of, you've got items for the summer school, you reserve them, but you've got other subjects, and you were talking about having ones, you know, just for on one day on Discord. Could you update that?
Okay, Mike.
I haven't forgotten that. That's on the back burner. I'll have to pull my finger out and look into that. So yeah, that'll be a New Year's resolution of mine to sort something else out for that. I think it'd be nice as well. It was an idea mooted at the same time about some sort of World Socialist Movement conference on Discord. Obviously, we'd have to sort of sync up the time zone somehow. But I think that would be something that would be nice to try, even if it's not a formal conference. And I know we already have input on Discord from people in America, rest of Europe and New Zealand. But yeah, I think that you know, make a prediction of some sort of World Socialist Movement meeting on Discord. But yeah, with the other sort of mini summer schools, I'll have to, as I say, get something sorted on those. Cheers.
Anyway, these meetings are continuing next year. The next meeting is on Wednesday, the 5th, I think. And the next... Paddy, you want to say something?
Just that somebody was saying to me the other day that they thought that, I can't remember who it was, that that post-pandemic is going to be a bit like post-war, post-First World War, where you had the Roaring Twenties. Can't remember who said that to me. So look forward to just parties every night and just, a spending spree and just one ongoing orgy. There you go. Prediction for 2021.
I'll soon have the Roaring Twenties than the Boring Twenties.
is that it then? Do you want to carry on or wind it up? Anyway, as I was saying, the next meeting here I think is on Wednesday, which will be something similar to this one, I think. And then the next Friday meeting is Moggy from New Zealand speaking about housing. That's on Friday the 8th or 9th. Anyway, it's the Friday of next week. Okay, well, unless anybody wants to say anything, shall I call this meeting to a close and see you all next Wednesday?
Okay, safe New Year to you all. Good luck.
That's what the editorial next month. Yeah.
See you next year, everybody. Bye.
Yep, see you next year, everyone.
Cheers.
Goodbye.
Thank you, speakers. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you. Bye.
Oh, yeah. I forgot to thank the speakers, so thank you, speakers.
Cheers.